if you're going to buy into the idea of capitalism at all, mm-hmm. then you have to believe in growth. Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason TV, and today we're talking with Ken Kersen. He's the editor-in-chief of the New York Observer, a role he's filled since 2013. The New York Observer is one of the most vibrant and exciting weekly newspapers in the country. Ken, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks for having me here, Nick.
Talk a bit about your vision for the New York Observer, and I ask this for two reasons. One is that as a young man living in New Jersey and then later in New York and working, the New York Observer was one of these great alt-weekly papers that defined what was great about New York. It had just rich voices, interesting stories, people complaining and kvetching and arguing on the editorial pages, great pictures by Drew Friedman and the like. So in that way, I want to know what your vision of this paper that was so important to me growing up is. But more importantly, in the alternative media landscape, it reinvigorated, along with the New York Press, it reinvigorated journalism writ large in New York in the 80s and since. How do you see the Observer working in today's world, which is much more dynamic than ever?
You just gave like a beautiful preamble for exactly what I see. You called it an alt-weekly, but I think it occupies a different space. There's really nothing like it in the country. Every city has its alt-weekly, but no other city has this sort of alt-weekly for the upper crust. And that's mm-hmm. that's what the New York Observer is.
Talk a little bit, but I mean, it's not something like you don't have to make $100,000 a year in order to read it. No. Although I'm sure your advertisers would prefer that, but...
Well, a lot of them do, yeah. Luckily. A lot of our readers do. But like I was saying, when I was brand new in New York City, I turned to... Jim Windoff's Off the Record column, just to literally find out who was being hired and fired in the media. This was before the internet. This was when to figure out, what Random House even was. Well, you had to read the New York Observer.
The Observer was the starting point of Sex and the City.
That's right.
For instance. So, this is the type of thing that it was trawling. And it seemed to be coming out of a kind of new journalism mode where the reporting was top-notch, but it was also highly personal or highly stylized. And a lot of personality. So what is its role now? We live in a city and in a media scape where there are a few titans. I mean, things like the New York Times are doing well, but everybody knows that's not where the action is. The action is almost any place else.
Well, I think people are hungrier than ever for the sort of warm, intimate relationship that readers felt that they had with the New York Observer during the period you're mentioning. So I've kind of doubled down on that. You mentioned Sex and the City. Candace Bushnell, great writer, chronicling her life and those of her friends. And so one of the first things I did when we started was really go on the hunt for another great sex columnist. Mm-hmm. We found one in Jasmine Loeb. She writes a beautiful column about what sex and romance and intimacy and really lack of intimacy is like in the mid-2000 teens.
Right.
Richard Kirschenbaum, great voice in our paper, chronicling these incredible weird insecurities of the ultra rich. Like one of his columns a couple weeks ago was hilarious. It's about how you can barely have a dinner party because this one won't eat gluten and that one doesn't eat meat and this one's a vegan and that one only eats local foods and wants to know where the radishes were grown, etc. And it's not just hilarious. There's a thread running through all of this, which is how hard it is to find your place in New York City. Mm-hmm. So New York Observer is about trying to make that journey a little bit more.
How does that play in the national scene? Because, that defines it for New York. And then what do you have aspirations for being a voice? You have, we'll get into your politics and your political background. You worked and wrote with Rudy Giuliani. What are the politics of the New York Observer and how do they exceed kind of being quarantined within the Hudson River?
That's a great question. The politics of the New York Observer are not my personal politics. I come from a political world and I think there was some nervousness or raised eyebrows when someone who had been a partisan political figure like myself became the editor. But everybody has their personal views and right. I try really hard to, of course they inform what I do. But I'm one member of an editorial board, and the politics of the New York Observer is really where Mike Bloomberg was. It's this sort of pro-business, but very
anti-soda.
If you would have seen me walking over here, I have a giant soda on my desk at all times, in violation of that.
So we'll talk about Bloomberg, and Giuliani was like this too. I mean, it's interesting because as he moved into the national scene, he had to, and to his detriment, he tried to fit more and more tightly into a Republican box. But as in New York, what was interesting about him is that he was pro-business, but he was also pro-gay rights or marriage equality or whatever. things that he couldn't be on a national.
Yeah, I want to correct a few things. I never thought Rudy changed anything or emphasized anything mm-hmm. differently. I think that's totally wrong. I think mm-hmm. Rudy took a ton of flack in New York for being perceived as a right winger. You might yeah. remember him trying to shut down Bam for showing the Piss Christ exhibit.
Actually, it was the Chris of Philly, the Virgin Mary.
Oh, that's right. Thing, yeah, right? It was the Virgin Mary. That's exactly yeah. right. You know, to me, he stayed exactly who he was. And maybe mm-hmm. that was a problem for his presidential ambitions. Right. But when he stood on a stage of 11 candidates, each vying to be more right wing than the next during these, you know, this endless series of Republican debates. And they did one of these gotcha, you know, raise your hands if you think Roe v. Wade should be overturned. Right. And he, you know, declined to raise his hand. I thought that actually was a great example of
political
courage.
He may have been,
courage.
Along with Gary Johnson, the only one who also said that they believe in evolution.
Yeah, there was a couple.
Well, but to go back to the politics of New York, I mean, New York is, you know, Bloomberg obviously is a billionaire. This guy knows how to make money. He knows how money works. He also was a nudge and a nanny. Giuliani had some of that. He famously cleared out Times Square. Went after the five or six squeegee men that were terrifying people coming out of the Lincoln Tunnel. So what is it, what is the kind of broad politics of New York? I mean, it's always a Democratic city, no matter who's the mayor. But you were saying that the New York Observer's politics are kind of like Bloombergian or Giuliani-esque.
Yeah, they're very pro-business. We expect, you know, you say cleared out yeah. Times Square as though that's some sort of, you know, fascistic thing. And Rudy mm-hmm. used to get called these crazy things. But, you know, we're sitting
well,
here.
Well, he is Italian.
That's why it's a cruel and vicious insult.
That's right.
But we're sitting here in a fancy
slur.
Hotel yeah. on 46th Street, right?
Right.
So the people coming here and spending their money here instead of going to Disney World or Disneyland or some horrible place like that are employing all of the people who serve food here and who clean the rooms and whoever. To me, it's, you know, if you're going to buy into the idea of capitalism at all, mm-hmm. then you have to believe in growth. And if you reject it and you want to be in Occupy Wall Street, that's right. a legitimate choice. But my problem with the people who objected to Rudy or Bloomberg is they wanted all of the good things, but they didn't. Then they wanted to wave flags when they didn't like this or that individual decision, and that's the part I could never get.
Is it? I mean, but does New York have to? I mean, don't you find it odd? And you're a Chicago native, right? Or Chicago,
yeah, Chicago
area native?
That's right.
So, I mean, don't you find it odd though that New York is like it's the toughest city in the world, it's out of control, and then you have mayors who are like, no, literally that soda is too big. You can't do that, or you can't have a strip club where right. you want to put a strip club. I mean,
that stuff gets checked. The Mayor Bloomberg's attempt to ban giant sodas, which I totally disagree with. I not only personally love giant sodas. I'm here because I believe in freedom and, yeah. and stuff.
You came to New York for the big sodas.
I did. Yeah. No, there are checks on that. So yeah. he couldn't get that passed despite all of his power. Rudy tried to do a thing where you couldn't jaywalk, right? He tried to put these crossings of like Avenue of the Americas in the middle of the road and
by the
everybody.
Way, we call it Sixth Avenue. Yeah,
it never worked.
Yeah. You know, so is New York still the capital city of America?
Absolutely.
No, okay, we'll talk about this.
It's not even worth arguing. I was just in San Francisco a couple weeks ago, which is the only other city in the country that I could see myself living in. I adore it. But even as it's on one of these periodic rises, that's a city that's always in either total boom or total bust, mm-hmm. and it's in a total boom phase right now. It's just, it's the scale is not there.
But you're saying that, you know, say Chicago or L.A., that what makes New York unique in the American landscape?
The scale. There is every, no matter how prurient, weird, interesting your particular thing is, there's a whole bunch of people who share that and are right there and have a group that'll meet about it. New York has a unique ability for a neighborhood to spring up and be great like overnight. I was on Sunday, I went to someone at the Observer, got engaged. I went to her party and got the address, and it's in Fort Greene. 10 years ago, you almost couldn't have gone into that neighborhood. Fort Greene in Brooklyn, and now it's this beautiful neighborhood, beautiful people walking on the streets, every kind of race, age, income class. You can't have that. Where I come from in Chicago, the neighborhoods that were horrible 40 years ago are horrible today, and it feels like they always will be, with you know a couple exceptions around those.
So areas. I mean, you see, New York is kind of the paradigm of creative destruction, the positivity of you know, capitalism and a mutation of creative destruction that Joseph Schumpeter talked about.
You know, without getting deep into the economic theory, you just see it every day on the streets. You just see innovation, partly because you have to.
So what happens? What chokes that off, though? Because, you know, there was a time not so long ago, certainly in the 70s and a chunk of the 80s, where New York was dead, or everybody just agreed, okay, New York was a dying beast that would give off heat for a couple more years, but it was over. What are the necessary ingredients? And, you know, and this might be something both as the editor of the Observer, but also somebody who worked with, you know, a mayor. I mean, we could spend a lot of time picking over Giuliani's record, but it's, you know, everybody says, like, okay, the city did great under him.
Yeah. So what are the rules? Crime is a big factor of it, and it's not for the reasons people always suspect. You know, in 4 years before Rudy became mayor, there was over 2,000 murders a year. When Rudy was done being mayor, it was 600. Mayor Bloomberg got that down to about 450, and it looks like our new mayor is doing a pretty good job, despite a lot of fears and hand-wringing. Right. Over it. That's a huge factor. And it's not because those 1,500 people not murdered between, you know, if there's 2,000 versus 500. It's more that the terror that everyone else feels makes them disinvest.
So you disinvest not just economically, but kind of psychically, in all sorts of every possible way.
You might send your kids. You're not willing to move from your nice neighborhood in Queens, but when your kid says, should I stay here and go to NYU or should I go to Northwestern, you send them to Northwestern. Yeah. Or you made a remark when you were introducing me as, you know, Rudy got those five squeegee men off it. You're right. It was a very small number, but they had a massive psychological impact on the exact people you want coming here and spending their money.
How do you know, you talked, and it's interesting to think about, that there are checks on the more autocratic or kind of, you know, bizarre impulses of leaders, even when they're very popular. But, you know, when does that go too far? Because, we're in the middle of and it's every week, just like there's a new neighborhood coming up, there always seems to be a police scandal. And there's one now. I mean, the police in New York are looking into using excessive violence against, a person in custody. How do you strike that balance between creating a safe place with conditions for economic growth and tumult, and then it just becoming too much like Singapore?
That's a bigger question than I'm prepared to answer. I mean, I see, my heart hurts for this guy who's selling, or allegedly selling cigarettes, Lucy's for 50 cents, right. And next thing you know, he's dead. It seems like an overreaction, whatever the facts are. And the police have a very tough job, and I'm very reluctant to criticize them without knowing the facts. I think everyone, police included, would say that was a horrible outcome. Especially considering the alleged crime. It's too big of a question to ask me how do you balance the needs of 8 million people vying for this very small physical space with limits on government power. But I will say, I think New York does a pretty good job. And I just rattled off a couple examples of where executives push it too far. Another one is Mayor Bloomberg, basically engineered the rewriting of the Constitution, the city charter, for a third term. A lot of people are outraged. Right. It was the key issue in the Democratic primary this time. But I think there's a heck of a lot of people who are pretty glad he did, because when he left office, even with all this wave of anti-Bloomberg sentiment, his popularity rating was about 60%.
Talk about de Blasio. I mean, because this is, in a lot of ways, people are like, okay, we've seen this movie before, where you bring in a liberal Democrat, or actually in the case of John Lindsay in the late 60s, a liberal Republican, and the city goes to hell in a handbasket. What are you worried about with a de Blasio administration?
You know, I'm worried about some of the rhetoric, Nick. I'm not that worried about Mayor de Blasio as a guy. I know him. I've interviewed him. I moderated a debate at which he was like the clear winner and with very thoughtful, measured responses. We endorsed him. But I am worried about the rhetoric.
Did you endorse him in the general election?
In the general election.
Is that partly because there was nobody else?
Well, his opponent happens to be a close friend of mine, so I wouldn't say there was nobody else, but it wasn't just because he was going to win, it was because of the masterful campaign he ran, and I think that tells you something about how someone's going to run things. Coming from the political world, I put a lot of stock in how somebody runs a campaign. I feel like Mayor de Blasio is off to a very good start, you know, with the normal amount of stutter steps. It's a hard job, a complicated job. I am a little worried about the rhetoric, this sort of tendency that he has to play to the furthest, most extreme elements of the coalition that brought him to power. Usually you see you see someone sort of play to that to get their primary, and then you know, sort of move to the middle to bring everyone in. I think that's a healthy part of democracy. You didn't see that in this case because he was winning 75-25 the day he won the primary.
So you're saying he actually, what is creepy or potentially troubling is that he, in the general election, he was more on the way up, he was more centrist, and now he's speaking to a left fringe.
It makes me a little nervous. Some of the housing, affordable housing rhetoric around there is really extreme, and I fear that's going to
Would you be able to convince him, you know, that these affordable housing scams are always... They're always scams. I mean, you know, like, is there any way to actually get a hard left mayor to just pack it in on that and say, no, you know, the way that you create affordable housing is actually by taking limits off of the ability to build more
You can never convince people of that. It's unbelievable, Nick. I agree with you 100% that the reason there's no affordable housing is because there's no affordable housing.
Yeah.
It's not because of
the supply is limited.
Exactly.
And more people
you artificially limit the supply, and then naturally you create these people who will never leave their apartment if it's at all affordable, and you have these artificial things hampering it. But once somebody buys into the idea that the government can put its thumb on the scale and fix it, you can never wind that back. And that's why it's so dangerous to start programs. They just never go away.
Let's talk a little bit about your career before The Observer, before Giuliani and whatnot. You dropped out of college. You were going to I guess it's a community college because it's named after a city, right? University of Chicago.
Yeah, it's a charm school.
Yeah, you dropped out of that. You started a band of some renown called Green. You started a magazine also called Green. Tell us a little bit about the band and the milieu you were coming out of.
I gotta correct your chronology which is that I joined Green, the band, which I did not start.
Okay.
I joined Green, which was already becoming a sort of a local happening, right out of high school. And I did that for 4 years before starting college.
Okay.
Then I did go to University of Chicago for a couple years. I think that's how I know you.
Okay.
Why
did you drop out?
To find my fortune in New York as a writer. I moved to New York City to be with my then girlfriend, now wife, and to take an internship at Harper's Magazine, and you know, become a media guy.
And then you started Green Magazine.
That's right. I started Green Magazine while I was working at a company called United Feature Syndicate. In fact, the way I knew Peter Kaplan, who was the longtime genius behind the New York Observer, is that United Feature Syndicate used to syndicate columns from the New York Observer. Mm-hmm. And I was the editor of those columns. So I would meet with Peter and tell him how I was going to chop Hilton Kramer down from 1,500 words to a more palatable right. Kansas City Star-sized 650 words, which is brutal because every word that Hilton wrote was brilliant. But things like that, or Joe Connison, or whoever we were syndicating.
So you, but you have this kind of DIY improvisation element to your career. So you decide not to go to college so you can play in a punk band. You leave the punk band, you go to University of Chicago, you drop out of that, you come here. You know, the next thing you know, you're advertising, you're running the New York.
Is that
Observer.
DIY or ADD?
We'll call it ADD. But is this the world that we live in now? And is it a better world where, you know, I mean, everybody is finding their own path. And, you know, what is there a through line to what you were doing that makes sense and that somehow reflects larger forces at work in American culture?
I think that this unbelievable emphasis on degrees and credentials is absurd. It's one of the craziest things. I actually think it's a scam. When you look at what people do to their lives in terms of debt, it limits their options. The whole reason you go to college is to increase your options, right? So you don't have to work at a factory, you can be an executive. But when you take on this staggering amount of debt that limits your options, it's like you've defeated the purpose. Plus, we've gotten to a situation where the only time how you performed in college ever comes up, if it does at all, is like that first time you walk into a job. Anyone who's had one job never gets asked again how he did in college. So, you know, I got a lot out of college because I started when I was 23 years old instead of 18. But had I gone to college like all of the kids from Glenbrook North who graduated with me in 1986, I wouldn't have learned anything. I was just too immature and too stupid.
What do you look at when you're hiring people at The Observer? You know, how do you hire them? Is it based on a resume or what?
I hire people who can write and who have passion. You know, we have all kinds of people at The Observer who, there's a long tradition of people there who are square pegs, right? They don't fit into it, and they go on to great things. This city is an all-star team of former Observer people, whether it's, you know, Ben Smith, who started our Politico column and now is the editor-in-chief of BuzzFeed, or a dozen guys at the New York
Times. And you mentioned
Joe
Connison, who had a massive run in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, and Peter Kaplan himself, who's a lot of people think was the best editor of the last 30 or so years in the city, and really was a huge inspiration and help to me.
So do we live in a kind of punkified age? And by that I don't mean, you know, that people are wearing razor blades, you know, through their cheeks or anything, but the idea of like, you know, you just figure it out. Like, if you know, you figure out what you want and then you go do it and make it work.
I think that's right, Nick. A lot of people were wondering how I could have taken off, you know, virtually 12 years from being a daily paycheck earner in the media and come back to be an editor-in-chief of a respected newspaper. And I told people...
Formerly respected. Yeah.
And I told people, you know, give me a year and tell me if the Observer's doing it. You look at my resume and it doesn't look traditional. That's a very small-minded way to evaluate this stuff. Look at the work I'm going to do and then make up your mind. Some people love it, I'm glad to say, and some people probably don't. But at least, hopefully, they're evaluating today's New York Observer based on, you know, what's now a year and a half of putting this thing out, instead of, well, he worked for this place instead of that place.
All right, well, we will leave it there. And we can check you out every day at the New York Observer's website and every week with the New York Observer in the print edition. So
that's right.
We've been talking with Ken Kersen. He's the editor-in-chief of the New York Observer, one of the great magazine or weekly newspapers in the country. Thanks for talking to Reason TV, Ken.
Thanks so much for having me, Nick.
I'm Nick Gillespie for Reason TV.